When you think of a God moment, what do you think of? Is it a big moment, a dramatic moment? Does God show up in a huge way and he does something that amazes everyone? There are certainly a lot of those moments in the Bible. And if you have followed Jesus for any length of time, you've probably had at least one or two of those moments. But what if there are a lot of God moments that we miss, right? Because we're looking in the wrong place? We're looking for something big. We're looking for something dramatic, but God is showing up in the quiet places. He's showing up in the little things. Now, we're going to look at a story in this message that shows us that God sometimes meets us in our deepest, darkest places. And he doesn't show up with a roar, but with a whisper. Right? He shows up with a gentle love that tenderly applies his mercy to our wounds and nourishes us with the strength that we need. Now, in my last couple of messages, I've talked about our need to be still and know that he is God. But in this message, I want to talk about the stillness of God. Maybe you've never thought about it that way before. But I want to talk about the stillness of God and how we can meet him in the quiet places and hear his whisper. Now, this is a story that happens with the prophet Elijah, and it happens in 1 Kings 19. But to fully appreciate what happens in 1 Kings 19, we have to understand what happened in 1 Kings 18. And if you want to pause the podcast right here and go and read those two chapters, that would, I think, be very helpful to you. But 1 Kings 18 is one of the prophet Elijah's crowning achievements, right? This event by itself would make him one of the great heroes of the Old Testament. And maybe this sounds a bit like a fairy tale, but it was a time of darkness in the land. The evil king Ahab reigned over the nation of Israel alongside his even more wicked wife, Queen Jezebel. And under her influence, Ahab has led the whole nation into idol worship. They are worshiping false gods like Baal and Asherah, and they're no longer worshiping God like they should. And another thing that he has done is, under her influence, they have beheaded every faithful prophet of God that they can get their hands on. Now, so far, Elijah has managed to escape Jezebel's wrath, and he feels like he's the only one in the whole country who hasn't turned his back on God. Now, God, for his part, has responded to Israel's disobedience and rebellion by sending a severe drought to fall upon the land. This has been going on for like nearly 3 years. And so now there's this famine, there's no food, and we find King Ahab himself is out scouring the land looking for water, any stream, any spring at all that might help supply his nation's needs. And then Elijah comes along and he confronts the king and challenges him to a showdown. I want you to show up to Mount Carmel with all of your false prophets, all of the prophets of Baal, all of the prophets of Asherah, and we're going to find out whose God is real. Now, this is a huge showdown, but Elijah is seemingly completely outnumbered. It's one faithful prophet against 850 false prophets, right? And then a bunch of people of Israel show up. You know, it's like this big thing, a big event. Everybody wants to come and watch. Now, Elijah challenges these false prophets to build an altar to Baal. And then they're to offer a sacrifice, or prepare a sacrifice, I should say, and pray to Baal, and then see if Baal will answer them and accept their sacrifice and burn up their offering. And so that's exactly what they did. They prepare a bull for an offering. They build an altar, and then they pray all morning for Baal to answer them. And for hours, they they beg and they plead, they dance around the altar, right? And they're even cutting themselves, trying to convince their phony God with their own blood. Elijah, for his part, seems quite amused by the show. He starts to mock them and taunt them. Hey, pray louder. Maybe he's going to the bathroom. Maybe he's taking a nap and you have to wake him up. And so this goes on well into the afternoon. And of course, nothing happens. 1 Kings 18:29 says, there was no voice, no one answered, no one paid attention. So now it's Elijah's turn. And he builds an altar of 12 stones, one for each tribe of Israel. And then he digs a trench around the altar and he puts wood on the altar and he lays out the bull to be offered. And then he has the whole thing completely drenched in water. And he does this not just once, not just twice, but three times. And so the trench is now a moat. The wood is sopping wet. Even a flamethrower could not start a fire on this thing. And then Elijah, he prays a one-sentence prayer. And God shows up in a huge way. Fire shoots down and burns up not just the offering, but the wood, the stone, the dirt under the altar. It licks up all of the water. And then Elijah, showing some major testicular fortitude, calls on all of the people there to seize the false prophets. And Elijah slaughters them all. All right. Rambo has got nothing on this guy. He is one tough hombre. Now, when we think of God moments and God showing up in a big way, right, this is the kind of thing we think of. Well, 1 Kings 18 ends with God sending rain to end the long drought. So we might expect in 1 Kings 19 that Elijah would be brimming with confidence, you know, right? The next chapter should be Elijah, you know, going on a victory tour, finally putting Ahab and Jezebel in their place. But that's not what happens. When Queen Jezebel receives word from her husband about what Elijah has done and how he's killed all of her false prophets, she swears revenge to do worse to him. She sends a messenger. And the messenger says, so may the gods do to me and more also if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by this time tomorrow. Right? Now, of course, she's swearing by gods, which Elijah has just proven to be completely impotent, and he's castrated them before the whole nation. Right? His response here should be, bring it on, babe. Let's see what you got. But that's not what he does. Listen to 1 Kings 19, verse 4. But he himself, Elijah, went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a broom tree and asked that he might die, saying, it is enough now, O Lord, take away my life, for I am no better than my fathers. Right? I have failed just like my fathers before me have failed. And Elijah enters this major depressive state. He's gone toe-to-toe with hundreds of false prophets, and he came out on top. Now he's running scared for his life from one nasty woman. Now, I'm sure there's a joke in here about a guy that can take on, you know, 850 men, but is scared of one woman. But I think we learned something very significant about human nature here, not just Elijah, but us, me, you. Sometimes we discover our greatest weakness after showing our greatest strength. All right, in three short verses, the entire story has changed from one of triumph to one of surrender. Elijah is snatching defeat from the jaws of victory. In fact, before he goes and hides in the wilderness, the Elijah prophet dismisses his personal servant in Beersheba. Now, Beersheba is the last border town you come to before leaving the nation, right? So Elijah is giving, well, every appearance of a man who's quitting and giving up. But two things happen at this point. The first is, all right, Elijah falls asleep, and who can blame him? Like, he has got to be exhausted. And he spent an entire day in like spiritual and physical battle. He's been confronting not only the forces that threaten his nation, but a fearful enemy that could threaten his own life. He then runs for his life on a journey from Mount Carmel down to Beersheba, a journey of about 100 miles. Right? His stress levels have got to be pegged. Right? And they've been pegged for hours, maybe even a couple of days on end. And there's this death warrant hanging around his neck. The second thing that happens is that God sends an angel to care for Elijah. Now, maybe this sounds like a big God moment, but it doesn't happen the way we might expect. Verses 5 and 6 says, "And he lay down and slept under a broom tree. And behold, an angel touched him and said to him, 'Arise and eat.' And he looked, and behold, there was at his head a cake baked on hot stones and a jar of water." All right. So an angel shows up in his time of need and makes lunch. All right, how long has it been since Elijah's had anything to eat? Probably a while. Now, just on a purely physical and human level, two things that we need when life is at its most intense is rest and nourishment, right? A good night's sleep and a good meal can do a lot of good. And yet, a couple of the things that we most neglect when life gets crazy is what? Proper rest and good nutrition. Right? We drain ourselves performing at high levels for hours, and then we shovel junk into our pie holes and wonder why we feel lousy, right? But that's not really the lesson of this text. But at a basic physical level, we've got a biological need for stillness, right? We need it for health, emotional and mental health, as well as our physical health. But that's just a minor takeaway. There is a kind of exhaustion, a kind of stress that you cannot sleep away or eat away. Now, we try. Right? We run to the kitchen and we try to eat ourselves happy again. And it feels so good going in, but then it leaves you feeling empty. Sometimes we try to sleep our way through emotional exhaustion. And you can even get to a point where you could sleep all day long, hours on end, and get no rest. And that's because your need is deeper. And the answer isn't physical, or at least not purely physical, it's spiritual. So I want to make a couple of observations here about God's response to our mental health. Now, the Bible doesn't use all of our mental health language, but we can certainly see it in the pages of Scripture. Elijah finds himself in a very dark place. Now, I'm not sure, playing armchair psychiatrist, if we can diagnose him with clinical depression, but it is obvious he's at a very low point. But notice how God responds to him. God does not condemn Elijah. He doesn't show up with a lecture or a rebuke. He shows up with a tender touch and with physical, spiritual, and emotional nourishment. God comes to us at our lowest point. You will never find yourself at a point so low that God will not meet you there. And notice how God also provides very practical short-term help. He provides food and he provides rest. And notice in the text how after the first meal that the angel provides, the angel doesn't like, "Okay, Elijah, time to get up, time to get back to work." No, Elijah is allowed to lay down and rest again. Right, so God doesn't rush him. He doesn't push him until Elijah is ready and he's gotten the rest that he needs. Also, God redirects our running. Right? Elijah ran to get to his hiding place. In fact, he ran more than 100 miles. Right, that's pretty impressive. But he wasn't running in either the direction that God wanted or for the reasons that God wanted. And so after tending to Elijah's needs, God puts him on the run again, but this time with a new purpose and a new direction. Now, some of us, maybe most of us, have come up with some self-destructive coping mechanisms. And these often become our default go-tos when times get tough, and we run to them again and again. But God wants us to run to him and run with him, to go the direction he's going. Now, God will take all of this energy and effort that we're expending in unhealthy ways, and he'll refocus it in a positive direction. Now, I also want you to notice here that this is no ordinary angel tending to Elijah's needs, and this is obviously no ordinary food he's feeding Elijah. Verse 7 reads, "And the angel of the Lord came again a second time and touched him and said, arise and eat, for the journey's too great for you." In other words, you're going on a long trip and there's no way you're getting there on your own. And then verse 8 says, "And he arose and ate and drank and went in the strength of that food," listen here, 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the Mount of God. So let's talk about this angel. Now, there are many appearances of angels in the Bible and in the Old Testament, and they carry out God's business in a variety of ways. But on certain occasions, special occasions, we see an angel that is called the angel of the Lord, not just an angel of the Lord, but the angel of the Lord. This is somebody special. Remember that angel simply means messenger. Now, in Exodus 23, God tells the people of Israel that the angel of the Lord, the angel of Yahweh, will lead them to the promised land. And they must obey this angel of the Lord because he says, quote, "My name is in him." Right? This angel is somehow attached to God himself. And there are times in the Old Testament where the angel of the Lord speaks as if he's just a messenger from Yahweh, but other times the angel of the Lord speaks as if he is Yahweh. So we get this picture that this angel is somehow identified as God, but also distinct from God the Father. Most Bible scholars believe that the angel of the Lord are Old Testament appearances of Jesus, right? Pre-incarnate appearances of Jesus before he was born, right? It's like the Son of God making a cameo before his big reveal. And that cameo here sets up this very intimate divine encounter for Elijah. Just picture it in your mind. Imagine that this moment, this interaction between the angel of the Lord and Elijah is actually an Old Testament interaction between a saint of old and Jesus himself. That's pretty powerful. Now, the second observation here is that we're not told what this meal consists of, but let me just say it's quite a meal because Elijah is able to journey 40 days and 40 nights on foot just on the strength of this one meal. Now, talk about a superfood. Right? If you could put this in a pill and sell it as a supplement, you'd be a very rich person. Obviously, something miraculous is going on here, and God is supernaturally sustaining Elijah for an incredible journey. Now, where is Elijah going? Well, to Mount Horeb. That might not ring any bells for you. We're told in the text that it is the Mount of the Lord. And there's a reason for that, because Horeb is also known in the Old Testament by a more common name, and that is Mount Sinai. God is taking Elijah to the same place where Moses had a very intimate encounter with God. We're not exactly sure of the location of Mount Sinai, but the most popular candidate would be a journey of some 260 miles on foot through treacherous terrain. Now, by way of comparison, you could run the Badwater Ultra Marathon. It is a 135-mile course that was conceived as a race from the lowest to the highest points in the United States. And you will climb 14,600 feet in elevation as you race from Death Valley to the summit of Mount Whitney. There's also the Marathon des Sables, which takes you some 154 miles in 6 days across the Sahara Desert in temperatures that regularly are over 100 degrees. You could compete in the Jungle Ultra, which starts in the cloud forest of the Andes Mountains and drops you 10,500 feet into the Peruvian jungle and running 142.6 miles through untouched Amazon rainforest, crossing 70 rivers and streams and contending with 100% humidity and whatever creatures you come across. Now, as impressive as those races are, here's Elijah running 260 miles through this treacherous terrain. But I also want you to understand something else here. There's some, we'll just call it fun with numbers going on here. You take any of the potential candidates for where Mount Sinai is, and you run the numbers, what you'll find is that this journey would require several days, but not several weeks, even in treacherous terrain. And if you run the numbers and calculate how far an average person can walk in a day, and even assuming that maybe Elijah is an older man, considering that maybe he has to spend some time hiding from Jezebel's assassins, you would find that this journey would not require 40 days and 40 nights. So what's going on here? Well, numbers in the Bible are not just used for their mathematical precision, but also for their theological weight. Now, there's no funny business or chicanery going on here. It was very common in ancient writings to use numbers, not only to communicate literal values, but also symbolic meaning. And we do the same thing sometimes, all right? Like you say something like this, well, that meeting was so boring. It lasted 100 years. Right, this hotel is so nice. I mean, how much room did this room cost you? $1 million? Right. Numbers are used not for their numeric value, but their symbolic weight. Now, 40 days and 40 nights is a figure that carries some theological heft to it. During Noah's flood, it rained 40 days and 40 nights. Goliath taunted Israel for 40 days. Moses spent 40 days and 40 nights on Mount Sinai with God. In the New Testament, Jesus was tempted in the desert for 40 days. Jesus ascended into heaven 40 days after his resurrection. Now, some of these events very well could have been a literal 40 days, but 40 days and 40 nights is also a way of telling us that God is doing something important, that it takes some time. 1 Kings 19 is telling us not only that this is a long journey, but it's telling us that it's a divine journey with a divine purpose. So be careful when reading the Bible and you come across numbers like this, and not to be overly pedantic. We can be like Spock in Star Trek, who can insist on numerical precision, but completely miss the point. Now, finally, Elijah gets to Mount Horeb or Mount Sinai, and what does he do? Well, if you took a lengthy journey, especially if it was a journey that lasted 40 days and 40 nights, verse 9 does not come as a surprise. There he came to a cave and lodged in it. Now, anyone else, do you ever have times in your life that you would just like to crawl into a cave and stay there? I know I do. Sometimes I think I can go into my cave and never come out. And sometimes it's a metaphorical cave, but there are times that I got to confess, I fantasize about a real cave. And if I could, I'd just go in there and I would hide in there. But here's the thing. We can't stay in a cave. So God speaks to Elijah. What are you doing here, Elijah? Why did you come here? What are you hoping to accomplish? But Elijah didn't just go to any mountain. He went to Mount Horeb, to Mount Sinai, a place that is loaded with meaning and expectation, the place where God met Moses one-on-one. This is where God spoke aloud to all of his people. This is where God handed down his law and made his covenant with his people. And we get a little better picture here of what's going on inside of Elijah's head. Listen to verse 10. He replied, "I've been very zealous for the Lord God Almighty. The Israelites have rejected your covenant, torn down your altars, and put your prophets to death with the sword. I am the only one left, and now they're trying to kill me too." I'd summarize it this way. I'm the only one left, and I'm fighting a losing battle. And so God gives Elijah an assignment, and here's what happens in verse 11, first half of verse 12. "Then the Lord said, go out, stand on the mountain in the presence of the Lord, for the Lord is about to pass by." Same thing happens to Moses, if you remember. "Then a great and powerful wind tore the mountains apart and shattered the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. After the wind, there was an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. After the earthquake came a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire." All of these phenomena, all right, the wind, the earthquake, the fire, are all marvels through which God had revealed his glory in the past. Even here at Sinai, the whole mountain quaked as God manifested himself in a storm of thunder and lightning, even as he appeared to the Israelite camp below as a pillar of fire. But this time, he wasn't in the ripping wind. He wasn't in the ground-shaking quake. He wasn't in the roaring fire. God shows up in a way that Elijah least expected it. Verse 12 ends with this. "And after the fire came a gentle whisper." Literally, it says a thin silence. Now, the King James Bible forever altered the English lexicon with its translation, "a still, small voice." We don't know what it was about that still small voice, but Elijah knew God was in it. Perhaps God simply whispered, "Here I am, Elijah. Come on out." Maybe there was simply a presence, an otherworldly sense about it. His skin tingled. All of his little hairs stood straight up as he was covered in goose flesh. Or maybe when God chooses to reveal himself in this way, you just know it. So Elijah comes out of his cave where he's been lodging, and he pulls his cloak over his face, either to protect himself from the elements, after all, there's been a fierce wind and an earthquake and all of that, or maybe to protect himself from the presence of God. Elijah stands at the mouth of the cave, and God asks him the same question that God asked before. "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And Elijah's reply is the same one as before. You ever feel like you're having the same conversation again and again? Well, Elijah says, "I'm the only one left, and now they're trying to kill me too." So God sends him back. "Go back the way you came," God says in verse 15. "And he is to anoint a new king over Aram, a new king over Israel, and he is to anoint Elisha to succeed him as prophet." Ahab and Jezebel's days are numbered, right? They're quickly coming to an end. And God also reassures Elijah in verse 18, "I reserve 7,000 in Israel, all whose knees have not bowed down to Baal and whose mouths have not kissed him." Here's what God's telling Elijah. "Elijah, you're not alone. You're not the only one." Now, 7,000 might not sound like a whole lot when you're considering a whole nation, but know this, when you feel all alone, when you feel like you're the only one, knowing that someone else is with you can make all of the difference. And maybe even as you're listening to this, you need that same assurance. You are not alone, you are not the only one. Sometimes all we need to heal, to continue, to keep going, to grow, is the quiet assurance of God. All we need is to hear him. But for that to happen, we have to be still and we have to listen. Think about it this way. Some of the most intimate moments that you share with your husband, with your wife, with a child, with a best friend, they're in the quiet, still moments. They're shared in whispers. They pass as a fall leaf drifting on an autumn breeze, in words not dared, shared loud enough to be heard by another. I'm not saying that the loud, boisterous moments aren't essential. They are. But the deepest relationships always have these still, quiet moments woven in. It's not always the loud, brash experiences that keep us close. It is the shared stillness that binds us and knits our souls together. That is our most visceral connection. True intimacy requires stillness. And it's there in the stillness that we find tenderness and affection. It's in the stillness that we share our deepest selves. It is in the stillness that we're at our most vulnerable and thus most able to fully love and be loved. True intimacy with our Creator requires stillness. We must be still because the divine lover of our souls often shares himself in stillness. And if you want to know God more fully, if we want to experience his tender healing on our deepest wounds, if you want to be lifted out of your darkest places, then you have to learn to listen for his still small voice. We have to listen to the quiet divine whisper. God will meet you there in your deepest, darkest place. He will meet you not with glaring disapproval, but with tender nourishment. He will reach out, not with finger pointed in condemnation, but with a healing touch. And he will whisper the words you most need to hear. But learning to hear his voice can be so hard for us, especially when we live such frantic, hectic lives. It goes against our very nature, especially for those of us who, you know, we strive to excel at multitasking. It can be hard for us to seek stillness, right? Stillness is not our sweet spot. Some of us are good at seeking intimacy in almost every place, except for the quiet place. We're good at hearing so many different noises, but we can't hear the quiet whisper of God. But we need to stop. We need to be still. We need to be quiet. And we need to wait. We need to wait and listen. And then we wait and listen some more. He will come. He will speak. Thank you. And God bless.